All right. Good evening, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm here with Dmitry Orlov, and we've been doing this series about the prospects of World War III, nuclear world war. We've seen how NATO has triggered Russia, the news in the last week about the long-range missiles. We've got Boris Johnson shut down the peace agreement. We've got Keir Starmer pushing to put the long-range missiles over in Ukraine. Dmitry, before we get into what these psychopaths are trying to pull here, putting all of our lives on the line, could you just tell the viewers a little bit about you first, your background, and what brought you into this mission and this research that you are doing? And a huge thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you. I'm an engineer. I worked in the United States. I had several careers, one in high energy physics, another one in internet commerce, internet security, various other things. Eventually got fed up with corporate life and started writing when it occurred to me that the United States is following the same trajectory as the Soviet Union did before its collapse. That turned out to be a very fruitful line of research. I wrote several books on the subject, have been writing essays and publishing books of essays on the subject. I'm living in Russia now, which is where I'm from, and I'm happy here, and still doing interviews and blogging in my spare time.
When you say they're on the same trajectory, could you expand on that? What do you mean?
Oh, the United States is going to collapse, as the Soviet Union did.
So, you know, in Adam Smith's Wealth of the Nations, you talk about great accumulations of debt for every nation always end up in bankruptcy. And we've got this story about the US dollar. Do you think that, you know, because there's been predictions for decades that the US is going to collapse under the weight of its own debt. Do you think that pyramid scheme can no longer be sustained? Do you think the collapse is coming quite soon?
Nobody knows when it's going to come, but look, a country that has to take on $1 trillion worth of debt every year, that was earlier this year, now it's every 90 days, next it's going to be every 60 days. Next thing you know, it's going to be $1 trillion a day, or the whole economy seizes up. That's the direction it's going. It's just looking at the numbers. You can look at where the trajectory ends. It ends in collapse and dissolution of the United States. I'm not alone in thinking this. For instance, I think a couple of years ago, I published an article titled "Putin Agrees with Me," because Putin came out and said the United States is following the same trajectory as the Soviet Union. So I don't think it was because he read my work. I think it's because his experts agree with me. And so there's general agreement on the subject, perhaps not so much in England, because England is in the shadow of the United States intellectually. But everywhere else in the world, this is becoming quite apparent.
So another one of my favorite books is The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. And we've got the overextension of the empire's resources in foreign wars. So do you see a parallel there? And because of the mutually assured destruction, is it the dance of the dying fly that America is saber-rattling over all these wars right now?
Well, the United States is really not Rome by any stretch of the imagination. It's actually Carthage. It's a piratical state, just like Great Britain was a piratical empire that went around the world and looted its colonies. Rome did not do so much looting. It was more of a civilizing force, and it remained a civilizing force for a very long time. Eastern Roman Empire in particular lasted for another 1,000 years after Western Roman Empire collapsed and had a huge civilizing influence on Eurasia, including Russia, and is the reason that Russia was very quickly able to absorb all of the fruits of classical civilization. and propelled itself forward, became one of the foremost nations in the world by the turn of the 19th century. So I wouldn't say that the United States is anything like Rome. I would say that the United States is like Carthage.
Okay, good answer. So here in England, we are getting fed news reports every day of, you know, evil Putin has invaded Ukraine unprovoked. And, you know, we've got to do stuff to stop this guy. Otherwise, it's going to spread like Hitler spread. What is the reality of the situation behind the BS from the mainstream media? The same guys who told us Saddam Hussein has got weapons of mass destruction.
Well, the reality of the situation is that there is no Ukrainian nation. Ukrainians are actually Russian. They're a type of Russian. And after the Soviet Union fell apart, they were very badly exploited by the Americans and turned against Russia. Slowly but surely, the minds of the young were corrupted for a couple of generations in a row to think of Russia as the enemy and to basically train and equip them to attack Russia, which is a futile, suicidal quest. So they did that not by attacking Russia, but by attacking the 100% Russian population in the east of the country. You see, the Ukraine was a territory slapped together by Lenin, by the Bolsheviks. And they did so by taking these rural districts in the west that nobody particularly cared about and slapping onto them industrialized areas in the east that were just part of Russia. So he carved off a bunch of Russian territory and lumped it into this newly created artificial thing called Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. So after the Soviet Union fell apart, the fact that there remained this thing called the Ukraine was just a geopolitical accident waiting to happen, and the Americans took full advantage of it. So after the Ukrainians, as they were, attacked their compatriots in the East and started a program of genocide, Russia had no choice but to intervene and to stop that genocide. And along the way has formulated the concept of this limited special military operation. The goal is to denazify and demilitarize the Ukraine to make sure that it never again poses a threat to Russia. That process is ongoing. The denazification is proceeding very nicely. Most of the Nazis are by now dead. Demilitarization has suffered from major mission creep because not only did Russia had to demilitarize the Ukraine, but it also had to demilitarize NATO. That is also going along swimmingly, and now NATO is very short of just about everything and is in no position to pose a serious threat to Russia except by committing suicide using Russia. So the only ploy that remains for NATO is something that could be called suicide by Russia. You attack Russia, fully expecting Russia to kill all of you immediately. But that's a very stupid thing for people to consider doing.
I think they are interfering with your microphone right now. I listened to one of your interviews the other day, actually, and the same thing happened every now and then. Your microphone started to make a crazy noise, and
that's actually StreamYard buggy software. You actually have control on your end to turn on and off noise cancellation.
All right, let's check that. So reduce echo cancellation is off presently. Yep, is that better now? Has that fixed it?
It usually fixes it.
Yep, there you go. You are fixed. All right. Apologize for that, viewers. We are fixed. All right.
It just sits there accumulating noise and then starts broadcasting it. It's just bad software.
All right. So just in layman's terms then, you're saying that, you know, NATO has triggered this threat to Russia. You know, Russia was promised that NATO wouldn't end up on Russia's doorstep, and they've just come closer and closer. It's like Mexico suddenly becoming communist and missiles being put in Mexico and being aimed at America. America wouldn't stand for that. Is that a correct analysis?
No, not really. Okay. Russia can stand any level of threat because Russia is it has won the arms race. The United States, and never mind the rest of NATO, the United States is decades behind Russia in the types of weapons that can be deployed. The United States does not have hypersonic weapons, cannot intercept most of what Russia can throw it at it, whereas on the other hand, Russia can intercept anything that the United States can throw at it or NATO can throw at it. So to give you a concrete example, the rockets that have been discussed as in let's give the Ukrainians, quote unquote, permission to attack deep into Russia with ATACMS, for instance, weapons. Well, recently, quote unquote, the Ukrainians, actually it's NATO troops that are manning those weapons, lobbed a dozen of them at the bridge between the Russian mainland and Crimea. Guess how many of them were shot down? 12.
12.
And guess how many hours there was no traffic on that bridge because they shut it down in case one got through. I think it was something like 4 hours total.
Wow.
So that is the level of damage that NATO can inflict on Russia at this point without going nuclear. So what we're talking about here is a whole bunch of nonsense, which makes sense because, you know, who's behind this nonsense? This character Starmer, I think his name is. I can no longer keep up with these, what do you call them, general secretaries or whatever
Prime
they
ministers.
Are.
Prime ministers.
Oh, yeah. But they're party functionaries, aren't they? They're all party functionaries. They're all just like some kind of emanation from some party apparatus, correct? Nobody votes for them as such.
They're lackeys for the military-industrial complex.
Yes, but in terms of the politics, they're party operatives, correct?
Yeah.
They're all Tories or whatever you call the liberals on your side.
But they're all pro-war. They're all pro-war with Russia.
Yes, but there are some job requirements for people like that, for party operatives, and the main one is being able to suffer fools gladly, because most of the people who get into party politics are just really foolish busybodies. So these people have no idea what they're doing. You wouldn't expect them to, but I think that Starmer had this brave. He can see that the UK is going absolutely nowhere, financially, politically, economically, etc. It's just kind of dead in the water now. But he figured that if he managed to get Russia and the United States into a fight, the UK could somehow duck out and maybe pick up some juicy pieces as a result. I think that was his entire plan. Is if Russia and the United States destroy each other, then maybe some life could be breathed into the corpse of the British Empire.
That is devious planning. But in an era of mutually assured destruction, I don't think he would survive a nuclear winter. So if you've got any questions, guys, we've got people in the chat right now. If you've got any questions for Dmitry, put them in the chat. We will get them to him. Dmitry's link, his blog, if you want to donate, it's in the description box below this video if you're watching it on the YouTube version. We've had loads of questions come in on the community wall. So we've got a question from Smile Be Happy about the energy that Russia provides to Europe. What is the role of that in this conflict?
Russia is the most reliable energy provider on the planet. If Russia signs a long-term agreement with a country, it will fulfill the terms of that agreement, even if it kills it. And that's part of a well thought out strategy. Everybody around the world knows that they can trust the Russians when it comes to energy. That sort of reputation is worth its weight in gold. And so Russia has signed a lot of long-term deals for the delivery of natural gas and some deals for the delivery of oil. And those deals will expire in 2027, if memory serves. But as, when it comes to quote-unquote hostile nations, and Russia maintains a list of them, and the UK is on that list, it is not going to sign any more such agreements. So there may be some Russian energy resources that the UK, for instance, or other European, Western European nations will be able to pick up on the spot market at rather inflated prices, or not. Meanwhile, Russia is busy negotiating long-term agreements with countries that are friendly towards Russia, that do not badmouth its leader or claim that it's about to attack them spuriously, which is a very reasonable stance.
So the most common question that's coming in is, do you think that either of the conflicts, Ukraine or what's going on with Israel, could escalate into world war?
Well, let's think about it. You have a tiny country called Israel. And you have a tiny country called Lebanon. And then you have not even a country, which is the Gaza Strip. And all of a sudden, and the world, by the way, is a very large place. So how does a conflict between a couple of tiny countries escalate into a world war? And people pose all kinds of facetious arguments in favor of it just randomly escalating. So, for instance, people around the Arab world and maybe Iran see women and children dying in the south of Lebanon and want to join the fight and just randomly go and start a fight with Israel. Well, they saw the same thing happening in Gaza, and that didn't cause them to react. And in fact, it is in the nature of the Arab world to not be particularly concerned by things going on in other Arab countries. Arabs are very hard to unite, and it's been that way for 1,000 years. So I don't expect that to happen. And some people say that, well, Israel could pull the United States into a fight. And then once the United States joined, then Iran would want to join. And if Iran joins, then it's backed up by Russia and China. And then you have a world war. And it's just like, you know, it's some kind of pointless name dropping is what it sounds like to me. Because the one thing that the United States doesn't want to do is get embroiled in a Middle Eastern conflict coming on the heels of its resounding defeat at the hands of the Houthis in Yemen. Remember that mission that the United States started to liberate the Red Sea and the Suez Canal from Houthi influences so that it would be open to maritime traffic again? Well, it is open to maritime traffic just for Russian and Chinese ships. It's closed for everyone else. And why is that? Because the United States is absolutely powerless to confront the Houthis, which are not even a country. They're something like a religious sect inside Yemen. And they do get some help from here and there. But they're just very good at what they do, I would say. And the United States is at this point very bad at what it does. It tried to scare them using an aircraft carrier, and then that aircraft carrier got a hole in its flight deck, so it was no longer an aircraft carrier. It became an aircraft transporter, and it limped back to Norfolk for repairs. And that just gives you an idea of what that whole imbroglio with Yemen appeared as. So given that the United States can't stand up to Yemen, why would it start a war in Lebanon? Because after all, Hezbollah is much more formidable than the Yemenis than the Houthis. So there isn't going to be a war. What's happening is that Israel has gone full-on genocidal. It's not only committing genocide in Gaza now, it's committing genocide in northern Lebanon as well. Maybe it'll find some other place to commit genocide, but that's not stopping its deterioration. Its economy is crumbling, and its military is overstretched, and it tried to pacify the Gaza Strip and gave itself a couple of weeks for it. Now we're going on a year, and they haven't pacified it yet. They've destroyed most of it. They've killed tens of thousands of people, mainly women and children, but they have not achieved their military objectives, nor are they likely to. So everybody's just waiting for Israel to die, and it's not necessary to go to war with Israel in order for it to die, because a lot of Israelis have multiple passports. A quarter of them are Russians. They'll just go back to Russia, you know, if things in Israel really become terrible. And a lot of them have been leaving anyway. So we're just waiting for Israel to just sort of blow away, you know, and it won't take a third world war to make that happen.
I don't understand how bombing and killing that many people can achieve any kind of a mission, because if I'm a civilian and I'm in a house and I get bombed and my parents' guts are on the wall the next day, first thing I'm going to do is sign up to fight. It just seems to me that they're creating more enemies and more people are going to want to rise up against them.
Oh, you don't understand the Israelis or the Ukrainians then. You see, it tickles their fancy to kill people. They love killing people. They love murder. They do it for self-respect. Same. Why are the Ukrainians and the various European nurse people who signed up with them who invaded the Kursk region in Russia? Why are they killing civilians? Why are they using drones to blow up little cars, little passenger cars of people who are trying to evacuate? Why are they torching houses for absolutely no reason? They're wasting tank shells, destroying little houses and villages, you know, little log cabins and things. Why are they doing that? Are they, is this in pursuit of something? Well, no, it just makes them feel good. They're warped people who have warped minds, and they thrive on murder.
And don't you think Tony Blair and George Bush set a precedent for that? When they said Saddam had weapons of mass destruction and they killed hundreds of thousands, probably millions, more than half women or kids. So, you know, what they did compared to what we're seeing today is 10 times as many people died. So doesn't that just like make it okay for these other psychopaths to say, well, if America can do it, we can do it?
Oh, no, I think bloodlust started out with, probably 500,000 years ago. It's part of human evolution. You either have civilization or you have this. So Israel has lost civilization and Ukraine has lost civilization. They are no longer civilized. And so therefore they will do this. They will commit war crimes until they can't.
All right, let's go over to another question there. You got a question from Jean. What does Dmitry see as an outcome, and what would he like to see as an outcome?
An outcome in terms of what, though? I mean, the conflict. That's rather unspecific.
Let's go with the two conflicts.
Oh, it's not what I want to see. It's what it's what's been ordered. And the Russians will just execute on their orders until those orders are fulfilled, and then they'll collect medals for it. and go home and play with their kids. And so the orders are to demilitarize and denazify the Ukraine. And so that's fairly clear. What the orders are with respect to Israel, well, there aren't any. Israel is just flailing randomly at this point, losing its economy, losing its society. In social upheaval, if you look at all the protests there, what's even worse is that, you know, the Israelis have very, very warped minds that preclude them from seeing the Palestinians as people. So there are absolutely no prerequisites for peace in that part of the world. And so I would like peace. I like peace. And so given that, the only way to achieve is to dissolve Israel. After all, Israel is a very temporary entity. It didn't really exist for thousands of years until the second third of the 20th century. So it would last maybe a century, and then it would be gone for another 1,000 years, and maybe in 1,000 years, another experiment will be tried. Who knows? Jews tend to be persuaded that Israel is an actual physical entity as opposed to some kind of a spiritual realm, which is what I think it is. It's a spiritual realm described in some holy books. There's no reason to treat it as a political entity. So if you think about it, Israel just didn't exist. It was part of the British Empire. Before that, it was part of the Ottoman Empire. Before that, what was it? Part of the Caliphate, I believe. Before that, it was part of the Roman Empire. And I don't remember what came before that, because that brings us back like 3,000 years or something, 2,000 years, too far in history. But there are books in the Bible that talk about the Kingdom of Israel, but we aren't clear whether those are works of fiction or not. In fact, there is no physical evidence, none. So they could be works of fiction. So if Israel physically ceases to exist, continues to exist as a spiritual realm described in various holy books, what's wrong with that?
All right, so the next question is from Kara. Will the U.S. election have any impact on the current conflicts?
Yeah, possibly. Kamala Harris, I think she'll be on a very short leash because she's an idiot. The question is, who's going to hold that leash? It could be that some neocons like Anthony Blinken managed to connive themselves back into the White House, although that seems really unlikely since the whole planet is laughing at him at this point. The loss of face is such that he might never want to be seen in public again if he's smart enough to know what's good for him. But that's pretty random in terms of who her managers are and whether they have any concept at all of what goes on in the world and what the position of the United States is. I think a good chance in terms of what Kamala's administration would look like is something that randomly lurches from crisis to crisis and makes each one worse. That I can see that very clearly in as kind of part of her managerial DNA. And that's what she did as a public prosecutor in California, and just made the situation worse. That's what she did as a vice president, made every situation worse. And so that's probably what she would do as president. With Trump, he's kind of a tempestuous geriatric who pays a lot more attention to talk shows on television than to boring briefing documents full of facts and numbers. And he's really too old to keep learning at the rate that the world is changing. So he will probably live in a world of make-believe where he believes that he's fabulous and will pay attention to people who will tell him that he's fabulous. And he will try to strike up personal relationships with people in various parts of the world, you know, try to talk to Putin, and Putin will probably talk to him. Doesn't mean anything because there's a gigantic organization standing behind Putin that works on facts, not fiction, not personalities. And so that wouldn't lead to anything useful, because even if there's a verbal agreement between Trump and Putin, by the time the detail-oriented people get at it, it'll turn out that the American detail-oriented people just aren't detail-oriented enough for the Russians, and the whole thing will fall flat on its face. So even if Trump has the best intentions, I don't think he will succeed at anything. And in any case, from the Russian point of view, the safest thing to do is to leave the United States the hell alone, seeing as it's hell-bent on repeating the path of the Soviet Union. You know, it won't be the United States. It'll be just a bunch of states. And Russia might even strike up bilateral relations with some of those states, Texas in particular. Texas is big in energy, so they speak the same language. And so Russia might start diplomatic relations with Texas, for instance. That would be a good thing. Some other former U.S. states it might pretty well ignore.
All right, next question then is from Smile Be Happy. What do you think the current Ukraine population is, minus the four oblasts that Russia annexed?
Oh, it's not even that. It's the fact that anybody who can has been leaving the Ukraine. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it started at something like 50 million. It's down to 20 million. It's the one country in the world with the highest death rate and the lowest birth rate right now. So in terms of demographics, it's dead. It just doesn't know it yet. Wait a little while and the Ukraine will cease to exist. And so that's really where it stands. On top of that, all of the able-bodied men have either run away or are in hiding or are maimed by the fighting. And so it's not really just the numbers, it's the quality of the society. The level of brain damage, they keep being told that they're winning, you know, ridiculous as that sounds. And the fact that all the more intelligent people have run away already makes it a very dismal place.
I find it sad that all these people are dying. You know, the Ukrainian people are dying, young people dying. We're seeing them getting dragged to the front line, etc., because of the machinations of NATO, Keir Starmer, Boris Johnson. It was in the news here that Boris Johnson was out there last week visiting the wounded, blaming Putin, yet he sabotaged the peace deal. These people wouldn't be getting killed and wounded in the first place. How many people have actually died, do you know, because of the conflict?
I don't have the exact numbers, but it's over a million of direct casualties. Quite sure that the numbers are north of there. Boris Johnson is the one prime minister you had who would actually be useful for something. If stuck on a pole in the middle of a field, he would keep the crows off the corn. I have respect for that. But other than that, I don't see that the Brits have much to do with it. The Brits are just basically, you know, eager little lapdogs for the Americans most of the time. I mean, Boris Johnson he didn't make up his mind to go to Kiev and do what he did to stop the Istanbul agreements. He got his marching orders from Washington. And he was just like an eager little pet, you know, jumping up and down oh joy, they gave me something to do. Maybe I'll get a doggy biscuit as a result. So, you know, that people keep talking about him, but he's not an actor. He's an actor. He's a bit of a clown. But he, in terms of somebody who's able to act on his own authority, he was never that.
All right, we've got almost 1,000 watching across all platforms. If you're in the chat, please put your questions in now. We're down to our last 20 minutes with Dimitri. We will get those questions to him. And we've got a question here from Mora666. So, with everything happening, what would the battle lines look like and who will side with who? Back in World War II, you had the Axis and the Allies. What would that look like today if full-on war would happen? And I'd assume that China and North Korea might take the opportunity to go after their targets, Taiwan, South Korea. What is the big picture, basically? So it's like, who would ally with who if it all kicked off into World War?
I don't think there would be time for that at all. So nobody would be in a position to find out what happened. There'd be some rockets flying and then you'd be dead. So the question is entirely academic. What dead person allied with what dead person? Does it matter? I don't think it really does. But I don't think that, you see, there isn't really a winning strategy to using a nuclear weapons for anyone. You do not win by using a nuclear weapon. And most military people like to think that they have a winning strategy before they do anything, at least a defensive strategy. Now, nuclear weapons are good as deterrent, so if people think that you're nuclear armed and you tell them under what conditions you will use your nuclear weapon, you can be pretty sure that those conditions will not be achieved, as we just demonstrated with Putin. Putin said, well, if you start lobbying long-range missiles at our territory, then we'll do X, Y, and Z. And nobody knows what X, Y, and Z were, because that would be a bit of an embarrassment all around. Little things that matter, not involving nuclear weapons necessarily or at all. But that's how these games are played. So we have the situation where the United States is in no position to go to war against Russia using anything, okay? And even though Biden is just insane, you know, he's non-compos mentis is the medical term, but he's been carefully sidelined when it turned out that he wasn't able to understand what Putin said, which is attack us with long-range weapons and you'll get X, Y, and Z. And as a result of X, Y, and Z, you will no longer be in a position to attack us using long-range weapons. So I think that Putin's whole approach is surgical. There is no surgical use of nuclear weapons. That's just basically you firebomb the whole planet and nothing useful comes out of it. It's an act of desperation. Russia does not have to resort to acts of desperation. Russia can surgically disarm the United States. And that's probably the message that was received using back channels going from the Russian military, from Russian Minister of Defense Belousov, to the US military Secretary of Defense, which caused him to basically say, you people, cut it out, please. And that caused a bit of a sea change within the White House. Now suddenly Biden's wife is chairing White House cabinet meetings. And suddenly Anthony Blinken, who was all hot and bothered to go to war against Russia, has been sidelined. And reasonable things have started happening.
It seems to me, Dimitri, that there's like, if you look at the recent centuries, there's like a 100-year war cycle. And the casualties are in proportion to the military technology. You mentioned, you know, about Russians' capabilities. But if you look at the amount of money that America spends on its military, I mean, the increase in the budget alone was more than what Russia spends in a year. And it also seems to me that these people who rise to the top of power end up self-destructing. If you look at Napoleon, if you look at Hitler, couldn't someone at the top of power self-destruct, but do it with nuclear capabilities, and the whole world gets destroyed as that scenario plays out?
Well, you're comparing the Russian defense establishment to the Pentagon, which is a dangerous thing to do. That's like comparing horses to pigs. Okay, so you have a bunch of pigs that eat 10 times more feed than horses. And therefore, the pigs are going to win in battle against the horses, right? Somebody's going to get trampled in that game, right? No matter how much you feed those pigs. The Pentagon is basically an organization for funneling money from the Congress to very few but very fat and nearly bankrupt defense contractors. Boeing is certainly circling the drain as we speak. And those defense contractors provide kickbacks to the various members of Congress who voted for the extra generous defense appropriations. So it's a corruption scheme. It's not a scheme for making useful weapons. And then the weapons themselves, what those defense contractors really hate is big production lines. Because you build a production line, you build so many tanks or howitzers or battleships or whatever, you fill the order, and then what do you do with that production line? Well, you scrap it, and you lose the profits that you hoped for. So what those defense contractors like to do is build very expensive boondoggles, just basically handcrafted, strange boondoggles, and the higher maintenance they are and the more spare parts they need, the better. So for instance, Russian aircraft can do sorties one on top of another. Basically, a crew lands, crew dismounts, they fuel it up, they hang new rockets or bombs on it, new crew jumps in, and the jet takes off. And they can do that continuously for weeks, months, and years. In the United States, it's something like 2 hours in the air and 2 days on the ground. I'm serious. And because that's so beneficial to the defense contractors, because there are all these spare parts that are needed, all this fancy programming that needs to be downloaded and periodically refreshed, bugs to be fixed all over the place. It's just wonderful for the repair crews. It just keeps them fat and happy and entertained. In terms of fighting a war against a country like Russia, completely useless.
Yeah, that ties into, you know, I trade and research the stock market, and I look at these contracts like Raytheon stock market shares going up and stuff like that. If you go back to Halliburton with Dick Cheney, you know, if a soldier picked up a banana in the canteen, then Halliburton got like $50 of taxpayers' money per meal. And it's just an absolute shakedown on the taxpayers. And these contracts, if you totalize them, they're like billions. They could go into the trillions of dollars over the years. So it just seems like war is an absolute racket. And these politicians get the political contributions, the kickdowns, and they just keep the contracts rolling out year after year. So you're saying because Russia doesn't have that system, the money they put into the military, it may be much less, but it's efficient investment.
Well, yes. First of all, Russia doesn't have a for-profit defense establishment. These are government-owned entities operated by the government for the government. Secondly, if you do not fulfill the terms of a defense contract, you don't pay a fine, you don't get more money, you actually end up with a criminal case against you. So people are really rather careful to not only do their patriotic duty, but do their best to stay out of jail while they're at it.
Makes sense. Okay. Yeah, I think in China, people get executed over these things if the contracts get corrupted. All right. So you've got, we're down to our last 10 minutes or so with Dimitri. Viewers, if you've got any further questions, final questions, put them in the chat. We've got a question here from Woost, and that is, taking out which world leader would buy time for the world and possibly stabilize things a little, if that is a possible situation solution. I don't know if that would stabilize things or make them worse.
I would say that Trump is the most likely person to buy time, just basically by pretending that everything is better than it ever could be, just by virtue of the fact that he's president. So Trump becomes president, and by virtue of the fact America becomes great again, and it remains great by virtue of there not being any really, really horrible news. And that is achieved by just basically not having any military conflicts, no disasters like the Ukraine or Israel or Yemen. Forget a bit about Taiwan. Suddenly, you know, Trump gets the mainland Chinese and the Taiwanese into a room together, and they all slap each other on the shoulders and shake hands, and nothing whatsoever happens except Americans just completely abandon the whole idea of doing something or other with Taiwan to hurt the mainland, and go back to declaring that Taiwan is China, is Chinese territory, just under different governance. And everything goes to normal, and the United States continues to decrepitate until there's no longer any money to pay out of the federal budget, at which point all the states, having nothing more to collect from Washington, go their separate ways. But it would still be America and would still be great.
Dimitri, what do you make of all these assassination attempts on Trump?
Well, that's a creeping Ukrainianization of the United States. As Nietzsche once put it, if you stare into an abyss long enough, it stares back at you. I believe that that's more or less what he said. Well, the Americans have spent a little too long staring into the Ukrainian abyss, and now it's starting to stare directly at them. Not that there wasn't a tradition of assassinating presidents in the United States before. You know, Americans are pushovers for political assassination. They just love political assassinations, always have. But the Ukraine basically took it up a few notches, because the Ukrainians, they have an entire system for assassinating people. Assassinated everybody that they could inside the Ukraine, so there's no opposition at all within the Ukraine. And then they moved on to try to assassinate people inside Russia with some very notable successes. Some people killed, some people maimed, etc. Now the Russians are starting to get very good at intercepting those cases. But now you have this this strange character who spent a couple of years bumming around Kiev and getting himself nice and brainwashed with the Ukrainian version of reality, if you could call it that. And then he has a long list of people he would like to see killed, including Biden, apparently, including Trump. He's just like into murder. That's what he got by hanging around Kiev long enough. And so he, you know, took this Ukrainian political assassination thing back home and tried to kill Trump. And how he managed to do that is a big secret, because only the Secret Service knew that Trump would be there. So you don't expect things like that to be investigated, because one of the hard and fast rules of investigation is never try to find evidence that would incriminate you. So you don't expect the Americans to actually ever conduct a proper investigation.
Yeah, that was the first thing I said when we were looking at the second assassination attempt, was how did he know to be there? And we looked at the history of the Praetorian Guard in Rome, how they were formed to protect the emperor, but how they became the biggest threat to the emperor. And we saw some parallels there. All right, we've got a question from Shemri. Who is the most peaceful world leader? Who do you view that as?
I think that Narendra Modi is the most peaceful one. I think he cares about karma, and that's significant. And India is not really going to war against anyone. And SCO and BRICS will pull India and Pakistan together. So they will no longer be on the verge of killing each other. And so India, I think, will remain peaceful.
Next question is from Richie. Why is the US so interested in Taiwan?
Same reason it was so interested in the Ukraine before things went very badly there, as something to use to attack and weaken mainland China. The U.S. sees itself as the ultimate world bully. Its goal is to keep everyone else too weak to oppose it, allowing it to do whatever the hell it wants. So Russia and China, and to a smaller extent, Iran, and to an even smaller extent, North Korea, are countries that the United States cannot tell what to do at all. So the Ukraine was the US ploy to weaken Russia, and we know how well that worked. And Taiwan is the US ploy to weaken China, and that's working equally badly.
All right, last 5 minutes for questions, guys. We've got a question from Kenneth. Might India prove a must-watch growing economy?
I think in terms of economic growth, China still leads. India is also at the top. I think Russia is third place, maybe third or fourth place. Russia is growing very nicely, around 4 or 5% a year. And then all of the developing countries that are growing but slower than that. And then you have the economies that are shrinking, which is basically EU, UK, US. The US doesn't look like it's shrinking, but like I said, if you borrow $1 trillion every couple of months, that may keep the picture kind of rosy. Just like if you drink a bottle of whiskey every 3 hours, then you may appear happy on the outside.
Yeah, they've had to keep marketing the fable ever since they came off the gold standard. So we've got a question here from Psychedelic Fish. How many proxy wars has Russia been involved in compared to the USA?
I'm trying to remember if there was a single one. There really wasn't. What wars have there been since independence? There was putting out fires between various ethnic groups that happened within Russia and on Russia's southern border. There was the very short war in 2008 with Georgia, where Georgia attacked South Ossetia and Russia intervened and demilitarized Georgia. And Georgia has never posed a military threat to its neighbors since then. So that was a success. That wasn't a proxy war. There was the American effort to build up ISIS, or the Islamic Caliphate, in Iraq and Syria, and Russia intervened and saved the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and wiped out ISIS and then pulled out. So that wasn't a proxy war either. And then the special military operation is not a proxy war. It's a direct intervention on behalf of new countries, Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, that Russia recognized, that then held referenda to join the Russian Federation, according to international law and the UN Charter. So again, not a proxy war. So Russia has been involved in zero proxy wars.
All right, there's an interesting question. What's your thoughts on BlackRock and migrant flows after the war?
Well, BlackRock thinks that it owns a lot of land in the Ukraine. And my expectation is that those deeds are not worth the paper they're written on, which may pose a bit of a problem for BlackRock moving forward. They may be in for a nasty surprise, but that's what you get when you when you're dealing with a corrupt government that sells you land from under the people living there without securing those people's agreement. In terms of the flow of migrants, I think the pulse of migrants will come out of the Ukraine once the Kiev government falls, because there are a lot of people in Kiev and other big cities, pretty much in the former Ukraine, that do not want to risk a confrontation with the Russian justice system because they're war criminals. And so they will flee. And where they will flee to the European Union. And how many of them will there be? Well, the European Union estimates that there will be between 3 and 5 million of them. So that's quite a few. And so the Europeans should really be preparing for some very nasty guests. Let me put it that way.
Who's going to house Zelensky?
Well, I don't know what will happen to Zelensky, but the thing is, you could put an end to the entire Ukrainian saga by just publishing a headline, Zelensky missing. And then after that, all the rats will flee the sinking ship, and the ship will, as you might expect, sink. There will be no more Ukraine. The old Bolshevik experiment of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic will be finished. And reasonable things can begin.
All right, next question. If Russian weaponry is that advanced, why haven't they just wiped out Ukraine?
Because the Russians don't wipe out territories that are inhabited by other Russians. You see, the distinction between Russians and Ukrainians is absolutely artificial. The Ukrainian language is basically a glorified village dialect spoken in the south of Russia that has been exploited as a kind of a nationalist Nazi communications device, if you will. The people who live in the Ukraine speak Russian. They're Russian Orthodox. They're part of the Russian cultural space. They're genetically indistinguishable from the population of the rest of Russia. And so they pass the duck test. You know, if it looks, walks, and quacks like a duck, then it's probably a duck. Well, the Ukrainians are probably Russian. And so why would the Russians kill their own people?
They wouldn't.
They wouldn't. And, oh, by the way, there are lots of other nationalities in Eastern and Western Europe that are definitely not Russian. And the Russians will not stop at killing them if crossed. So that's really something to keep in mind. So the Russians will not kill Ukrainians, but they will sure as hell kill Swedes or Finns or Germans or whatever.
Dmitry, thank you for your time. You're a wealth of knowledge. I've learned so much speaking to you. Is there anything you'd like to say to the viewers in conclusion? And you know, what can they find at your blog?
Please go to boosty.to/clubOrlov, club ORLOV and subscribe, or there is a sign up, a 30-day free membership, and read what's there. And I hope you enjoy it and come back.
Huge thank you for coming on, answering all the questions, and we'd love to get you back. And you have a great rest of your day, Dimitri. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. All right, guys, another great guest on giving a different perspective from the Western mainstream media. That's what we're trying to bring you with these interviews. Now, I'm not trying to, I know some people in the comments have said, you know, what, get someone on that gives the Ukrainian side of this. You know, I criticize the psychopaths, the New World Order, the globalists, Bush, Blair, Cheney, Bush crime family, Clinton crime family, Boris Johnson, Tony Blair, Keir Starmer. These are the people who are in the club who have manipulated this war in Ukraine. And my heart goes out to the Ukrainian people. I'm absolutely disgusted by the amount of people that have died. You know, what Dimitri just said, was it 1 million people have died? My heart is breaking. I have a friend who's got Ukrainian people living in his house. I fully understand the history of Ukraine. There was a lot more to it than what Dimitri said. If you look at the history, if you read the history books, you know, going back hundreds of years to the Ukrainian Rus, the Vikings coming in, how the Ukraine was thriving, that part of the country before Moscow. And then you've got the Mongols coming in and raiding it. The horrors of what the Ukrainian people went through under Stalin with the terror famine, what they went through during the world wars. I completely understand all of that. And I sympathize with the Ukrainian people going through these things, just like the Polish people went through horrific things during the world wars because the country's like in between these battlefields. So I think what we should do is perhaps get someone on who is pro-Ukraine and have them debate with someone who is pro the Russian side. And when I say pro-Ukraine, when we are exposing Ukraine, we're not criticizing the Ukrainian people. Look at the videos of them getting dragged to the front line, the young people. I'm absolutely sickened by the mainstream media here. They're showing, you know, all this stuff. It's just rallying and trying to escalate and keep the war going so the military-industrial complex can make all of this money. So anyway, that's my disclaimer. I think Ron's about to go live right now with the P. Diddy stuff. Huge thank you for all of your questions, guys. I learned so much from these interviews, and I just try to remain a neutral host so we can get a variety of perspectives on the channel. I'm not condoning the death of people in any of these countries. I'm against murder, and I wish we could all just live in peace. But it's these psychopathic politicians manipulating people. They have blood sacrificed the young people of Ukraine, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm disgusted by that, and I will try and expose that all day long. So, yeah, thanks for tuning in, guys.